Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Michelle Cameron, author of Babylon, a novel of Jewish captivity. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. It's Labor Day weekend, which in many parts of the country is the last hurrah of summer. Here in the Sonoran Desert where I live, Labor Day is just a brief interruption in an already busy fall schedule. Long before this holiday became another American excuse for a three-day weekend, Labor Day was a significant statement about the value of a human being's hard work. When it began, the very concept that labor had value, morally and economically, was controversial, as it remains in some quarters. Labor Day was created in the 1880s to support the working man and woman as an expression of the importance of organized labor in America. It was a way of saying that labor mattered, that capital isn't the only positive value in the U.S. economy and society. We Jews have always believed that labor has a moral quality. One of the great sentences in Pirkei Avot, the ethics of our ancestors in the Mishnah, says, Al shlosha dvarim ha'olam omeid al ha'torah ve'al ha'avodah ve'al gemilut chasadim. The world is based on three things, on Torah, on labor, and on acts of selfless kindness. The Hebrew word avodah, labor or work, can mean religious service, but typically it means practical and prosaic work. And it is likely that the connection of labor to divine service is intentional. In other words, honest work is a form of prayer. This exaltation of basic labor as the foundation of society and a way to serve God is consistent throughout Jewish tradition. You might not know that until fairly recently, being a rabbi wasn't even a paying profession. Most of the great rabbis and scholars in Jewish history had day jobs, from Rabbi Yossi HaSandlar, a shoemaker in Talmudic times, to Rashi, a wine merchant in the Rhineland in the 11th century, to Maimonides, a physician in 12th century Spain and Egypt, to the rabbis of Eastern Europe, who made a living in the lumber trade or worked as butchers. For Jews, there has never been any shame in hard work. In fact, a movement based on exalting work, the labor Zionists, created the State of Israel. The first immigration of Jews returning to Israel in the 19th century was made up of idealistically motivated labor Zionists, what we call today socialists. They created the institutions of the modern State of Israel, including the Histadrut, the labor union-based organization that still has enormous influence in Israel. Until the late 1970s, every single prime minister of Israel came from the Labor Party. Its influence in the Knesset has eroded steadily since, but the mythos of Israel is deeply imbued with exaltations of labor and work. Zionist songs include lines like Hechalutz leman avodah, avodah leman hechalutz. The pioneer lives for the work, and work is there for the sake of the pioneer. And of course, one of the great old institutions of Israeli life, the kibbutz, which did more to shape the character and reputation of Israel than virtually anything, well, the kibbutz is based on labor. Here in America, many important labor organizers, from Samuel Gompers to Emma Goldman, were Jewish. Gompers, founder and longtime president of the American Federation of Labor, the AFL, part of the AFL-CIO, said, Labor Day differs in every essential way from other holidays of the year in every country. All other holidays are connected with conflicts and battles of man's prowess over man, of strife and discord for greed and power, of glories achieved by one nation over another. Labor Day is devoted to no man, living or dead, to no sect, race, or nation. Abraham Lincoln said, "Labor is prior to and independent of capital. Capital is only the fruit of labor, could never have existed if labor had not first existed. Labor is superior to capital and deserves much the higher consideration." A personal note on the subject of labor, my own maternal grandparents, my Zadie Lou and Bubby Dora, were members of a group called the Workman's Circle, the Arbeiter Ring. Socialists who didn't much believe in God, perhaps, but certainly believed in Jewish life and the value of labor and workers. I used to do a Passover Seder for the Arbeiter Ring every year that managed to make no mention of God, but was otherwise about as traditional as you could imagine, except Moses seemed like a union organizer. Without making this a commercial for Look for the Union Label, it's important to remember that in Jewish tradition, avodah, work, labor, retains a high innate value, especially over this Labor Day weekend. Labor Day always falls just a bit before Rosh Hashanah, and this year, as we prepare for the season of introspection and self-improvement, I will continue to urge all of you to help the victims of the Maui firestorm. Donate to the Hawaii Community Foundation's Maui Strong Fund. We are told throughout the High Holy Days, Uteshuvah tefilah tzedakah. Repentance, prayer, and charity set aside the severe decree. That is, our own actions can change our world and the entire world. It is a note of personal responsible empowerment in this season of self-examination. So make a difference this coming year of 5784, and do so beginning now as we prepare for Rosh Hashanah, the Yom HaDin, the Day of Judging, coming up in less than 2 weeks. To play us in this morning as a preview for the coming High Holy Days, here's Barbara Streisand's rendition of Janowski's magnificent Avinu Malkeinu. A brief story about that. Barbara Streisand's mom was a member of my dad's congregation, Temple Emmanuel of Beverly Hills. One Kol Nidre Eve, between services, they used to have to do two services to accommodate everybody, there was a knock on his office door, and who was standing there? Barbara Streisand. She said, "Cantor, you sang something in front of the open ark during services. I wondered if I could have the music for that." My dad answered, "I didn't write that. Max Janowski did, but it's a published composition. I have a printed copy I can give you." And so my dad gave it to Barbara Streisand, and she recorded it. It became an unexpected hit for her. Here it is. Streisand's recording of Janowski's Avinu Malkeinu for the coming holidays of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, less than 2 weeks away now. Slichot, the gateway to the High Holy Days, is coming up this Saturday night. Join us at Congregation Beit Simcha at 8 p.m. for Havdalah, Shofar dessert, study, and the gorgeous Slichot service with High Holy Day music. And Rosh Hashanah begins Friday night, September 15th. Our guest on Two Jewish This Morning, Michelle Cameron, has written an excellent novel about a nearly unexplored period of Jewish history. Find out why when she joins us in just a moment here on Two Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
This Is Judaism offers everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism, but were afraid to ask. Who is Abraham? What is the Torah? How long have Jews been around? What do Jews believe about life after death? In three fun, inexpensive, informative sessions, This Is Judaism brings you the joy of Jewish life and learning. You'll study with Rabbi Sam Kohan and learn what Jewish values, spirituality, and community are all about. Plus, you can get a sample of delicious Jewish foods. Classes are at the Tucson JCC, the J, and are open to everyone, Jewish or not. Best of all, This Is Judaism is completely free, but the learning is invaluable. Want to know what your new Jewish relatives are all about? Want your kids to understand Jewish heritage, history, and holidays? Want to try some delicious Jewish food? Then This Is Judaism is for you. There's no charge, but you must pre-register by calling 520-276-5675. Visit BeitSimchaTucson.org or email rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org. This Is Judaism is taught on three consecutive Sunday afternoons in September and October at the Tucson JCC. There's a free Zoom option, but registration is required. All classes are with Rabbi Sam Kohan. Remember, there's no obligation, and registration is completely free for this wonderful introduction to Jewish life. Register for This Is Judaism by calling 520-276-5675. It's the most effective introduction to Jewish learning and life ever. For your very own entry or return to Judaism, visit BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675.
We welcome our guest with a little musical play-in associated with the name and theme of her new novel.
By the
We are delighted to welcome to Jewish our guest this morning. Michelle Cameron is the author of the remarkable new novel, Babylon, a novel of Jewish captivity. She is head of the writer's circle, teaches and writes, and it's... I think this book's going to win some awards. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you very much, Rabbi. I'm delighted to be here.
So this is a really unusual setting for a Jewish novel. We must receive, I don't know, hundreds of Holocaust-related books. This is a kind of Holocaust book, but set in antiquity. Why did you decide to write about the Babylonian destruction?
Well, I tend to write in all of my novels about little-known episodes of Jewish history. And it was when I was writing my first historical novel, The Fruit of Her Hands, that as I was writing, I wrote a passage about the burning of 24 cartloads of Talmud volumes.
Right.
And I don't know where it came from, but my heroine basically thought about the psalm by the rivers of Babylon. And something in me was moved. And so I started to look at the history of the Babylonian exile and decided that that would be my next novel. Another reason why I was so strongly attracted to it is because of the theme of assimilation versus maintaining religious tradition, which of course was a very strong component of the Babylonian exile, of the Judeans, who were very tempted by the wealth and the gods of Babylon.
When you wrote The Fruit of Her Hands, the Shir of Ashkenaz story, you were writing about a distant ancestor of yours. Do any of us know if we had distant ancestors in the Babylonian exile?
I think probably not, unless, you know, you could say that we all come from, you know, that period of time. But no direct ancestors, absolutely not.
The research for a book based so deeply in antiquity, trying to get right the verisimilitude, the details about how life actually worked then. How much research did you have to do?
Oh, I do a tremendous amount of research on all my novels. I will say that this one was trickier than most. There's a surprising amount of information about medieval Europe and the rise of anti-Semitism in medieval Europe, which was The Fruit of Her Hands. And of course, with my novels about Napoleon, there's so much research that you could drown in it. There's less, obviously, about antiquity. And so a lot of what I based my work on was obviously the books that I could locate, but also, of course, the stories from the Bible, that's a lot of what I based this novel on.
We will talk much more with Michelle Camerota about her novel Babylon, a novel of Jewish captivity, when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in less than 5 years, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary, 520-276-5675. And we are inviting guests to join us for the High Holy Days. Go to our website to find out more. It's time, by the way, to have those kids in Hebrew school. Religious school registrations open now for school-aged children and grandchildren. Our fabulous Sunday Hebrew school, Bar and Bat Mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation and teen programs all meet in a fun, relaxed setting with outstanding Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimcha Tucson.org to sign up. Beit Simcha's services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us in person Friday night and Saturday morning. Email me, rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimcha Tucson.org. Join us every Friday night, either in person or come on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services, 6:30 p.m., Torah studies at 9 a.m., in person and on Zoom, and morning services on Shabbat are at 10 a.m. every week, all with me leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are available live and on Zoom. You can access those. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Our wonderful religious school is available in person, but also in blended format on Zoom. The High Holy Days are coming up super fast. Slichot is this Saturday night at 8 p.m. Join us for Slichot and for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, beginning September 15th and 16th. Guests are all welcome. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up now. For more information about Beit Simcha to come to services, High Holy Days, religious school, Torah text programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and of course all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A, Tucson.org. Or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, the fastest growing Jewish congregation and community in all of Southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or a criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O, Jewish Radio 18 at Gmail, or come to our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 200,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify. Go to 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. You can send us an email or go to the website. Post a rating, review 2Jewish wherever you listen to us. All those comments help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of Southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen. 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470 to speak to a family advisor at Evergreen. Call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Last week, you mentioned a news story about Russian archaeologists finding a Second Temple period synagogue on the shores of the Black Sea, which is really fascinating. I wasn't aware there were Jewish communities there then. Not sure anybody was aware there were Jewish communities there then, although certainly it could well have been. The steppe area that goes from the Black Sea and just kind of goes north and east is an enormous part of the world. And Jews have had important communities in that area for a long time. I jump from that all the way up to the Middle Ages and the Khazar Empire. But can you give us a little bit of a background about the Jewish world in that area?
Yeah, first of all, with all due respect, I have to quibble with your use of the term the steppe.
Okay.
Because a lot of the territory you're describing north and east of the Black Sea is not steppes. It's Ural Mountains, it's Siberia,
sure,
it's tundra, it's all kinds of things.
Right.
Steppe is a limited part of that region.
But still very large.
It's a very large region. It spans 11 time zones.
Yeah.
But let's think first in terms of the first century of the Christian era or the last century of the pre-Christian era, the very late Second Temple period, and see that from the perspective of people in the Eastern Mediterranean, the Black Sea was like an arm of the Mediterranean Sea. It was a continuous sea connected by the Bosphorus and the Dardanelles. And largely, oversimplification, but largely the eastern part of that, the Black Sea and its coastline, were controlled by the Greeks. The western part, the whole Mediterranean coast, was initially controlled by the Greeks, but eventually taken over by the Romans. And we know that in the first century of the Christian era, there were Jewish communities all throughout the Mediterranean world, on the coast.
Everywhere.
There were trading posts and commercial things and ship provisioners and chandlers and all that stuff. And these were the beginnings of, in some cases, still existing Jewish communities in the Mediterranean world. Well, so the same thing apparently, but we focus on this area less because it's less accessible, is true of the Black Sea. And a lot of our people, if you think about it, come from one very important Black Sea port, which is Odessa.
Yeah.
You know, in the last quarter of the 19th century, it seemed like a third of the Jewish world was in Odessa, a third was in New York, and a third was everywhere else.
Yeah, Odessa was the center of the Yiddish publishing world and poetry and all kinds of arts, culture,
right.
Hugely important place.
And that, of course, is not an ancient city. That's a late 18th century city planned by and sort of decreed by Catherine the Great. So it doesn't stretch back into antiquity, but lots of settlements do. Now, once you get north and particularly east of there, things change because you're entering the Turkic world, the Turkic-speaking world, much of which we now refer to collectively as the Stans, which is, to remind your listeners who may be less familiar with this pretty much unknown region, it's Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, and which have I forgotten? Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Turkmenistan, and Tajikistan.
Tajikistan,
sorry.
Okay.
All right. And
by the way, if our listeners are familiar with it, it shouldn't be through Borat movies, unfortunately.
Right. And Tajikistan is the one of those five countries which has a language that is much more closely related to Persian than to Turkish. But the other countries all have languages that are mutually comprehensible with Turkish.
Turkic origin in any case.
Yeah, and they all were initially settled by people of the steppes, like the Mongols, who were a surprisingly tolerant group. And we'll talk about some of the Jewish communities that grew up in those areas next week.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk then.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. My uncle's grandson was lead singer in the synagogue. Does this make him my first chazan once removed? You see, chazan is the Yiddish word for cantor, first cousin. Never mind. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. In this week's portions of Nitzavim and Vayelech, Moses is nearing the end of his leadership and his life. That gives special poignancy to his message here. It is the last will and testament of Moshe Rabbeinu, kind of Moses on management. What will Moses teach us about how to carry on after he's gone? How will our greatest leader pass the baton, and who will he give it to? The answer comes quickly, and it is, well, a kind of surprise. In Nitzavim Vayelech, Moses' great message is not that he is passing the mantle of control to his successor Joshua. I mean, he does that. But his central teaching is that of leadership through empowerment. Every Israelite, each Jew, can grasp the central concepts of our contract with God and fulfill it. Every single Jew has the capacity to fulfill the Torah, our ethical commitment to God. We each have the responsibility to do so and the choice to carry it out or not. And that thousands of years old lesson has meaning for us today. What makes this particularly appropriate is that we are close to completing Deuteronomy, a text filled with ethical and moral laws for personal conduct. Give to the poor, the stranger, the orphan, and the widow. Treat employees with generosity, kindness, and respect. Protect others against negligence. Deal honestly in business. Be gracious and moral in your treatment of animals. Reward loyalty. Do not seek to humiliate others. Live a life of commitment to ideals. Keep your word and your vows. Of course, we don't have to actually do any of this. As Moses states clearly in God's name here in Nitzavim Vayelech, we can choose to do otherwise, to act unethically. That'll simply create a rotten world, institutions not worthy of respect, personal lives based in deception and dishonor. We can choose not to support the needy, to ignore the homeless, to leave those who teach Torah without the means of support to do their essential work. It is always our choice. Well, we are approaching the time for tshuva, return and repentance. Slichot is this Saturday night at Beit Simcha at 8 o'clock. Rosh Hashanah less than a week away, and the message in our portion is clear. This Torah of ours is not too hard for us. It is not too far from us. It is here, now, close in our hands. It is up to us to learn it, live it, and do it. Well, it's not a bad last speech from Moses on this final Shabbat of the year, nor a bad lesson for the end of this year, 5783, the beginning of the next year, 5784, which starts a week from Friday night. It's a good message anytime. When we come back in a moment, our guest this morning, Michelle Cameron, explains how she is attracted to important moments in Jewish history that are poorly understood, not well explored, and how she turns them into compelling novels. Find out when we return here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The anti-Semitic acts on college campuses get weirder and weirder. Local police are investigating after the A.E. Pi Jewish fraternity at UC Berkeley. I should note that I went to UCLA and was an A.E. Pi there and highly active. They reported finding hundreds of shellfish dumped across its property. The shellfish were also thrown through a window at Berkeley's chapter of A.E. Pi in what the fraternity is calling an act of anti-Semitic vandalism. Crayfish were thrown all over our deck, all over the side driveway, through the windows, into somebody's room, and scattered all around the backyard, said Jaden Gershon Friedberg, a Berkeley senior and Alpha Epsilon Pi chapter president. A fraternity brother saw a half dozen people with a bucket approach the house just before 1 a.m. Gershon Friedberg and other fraternity brothers immediately checked around neighboring frat houses to see whether shellfish had been dumped on their property. Nope. A.E. Pi was the only target. We realize this is more than just a prank, Gershon Friedberg said. Given that the perpetrators used shellfish, forbidden under the laws of keeping kosher, and targeted a Jewish fraternity on the first Shabbat of the school year, A.E. Pi considers the incident to be anti-Semitic. This undoubtedly was deliberate, aimed at intimidating our chapter, A.E. Pi said. The vandalism comes 2 weeks after Alpha Epsilon Pi's national office launched a partnership with the Anti-Defamation League. The fraternity's umbrella organization will hire a staffer to train members across its 150 chapters to respond to anti-Semitism and advocate for Israel. A.E. Pi was founded over a century ago after Jews were excluded from NYU fraternities. A.E. Pi CEO Rob Dertiger said chapter members are on the front lines of this battle on college campuses. A.E. Pi filed police reports with both Berkeley City and the campus police at UC Berkeley. They hope they will investigate the vandalism as a hate crime. The Berkeley Police Department confirmed it's investigating. A.E. Pi's national office paid for a cleaning crew to clear away the disgusting decaying shellfish and pressure wash the deck. In Israel, a Palestinian terrorist rammed a truck into a group of soldiers, killing one and wounding five before being shot dead. In the latest incident, amid an ongoing escalation of Palestinian violence against Jews. In the terror attack, the driver, a 41-year-old West Bank Palestinian with an Israeli work permit, swerved and hit the soldiers at a checkpoint on the border of the West Bank leading into central Israel near the Israeli town of Maccabim. The driver fled and was shot dead at another checkpoint. One of the wounded soldiers remains in critical condition. Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu said he will convene a security review at the defense ministry. And a Palestinian terrorist used a kitchen knife to stab a man at a light rail station next to Jerusalem's Old City last week. Policemen on the light rail car saw the stabbing, followed him, and shot the assailant dead. First responders said the stabbed man was conscious and suffered moderate injuries. The unidentified victim, stabbed in the back by a Palestinian terrorist, is in his 20s. His condition is stable. This attack comes amid this surge of violent and murderous attacks by Palestinians in both the West Bank and Israel itself, including shooting attacks on Israelis in the West Bank, attacks by Palestinians within Israel, and military raids on Palestinian terrorist sites. Since the beginning of the year, more than 24 Israelis and more than 100 West Bank Palestinians have been killed in the violence. In other news that reflects both the growing cultural polarization in Israel and American political influence there, Israel's National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir is barring government employees under his supervision, which include police officers, firefighters, and prison officials, from participating in a long-standing and prestigious Wexner Fellowship program for Israeli civil servants at Harvard University. Ben-Gvir issued the ban due to what he calls the left-wing political bent of the program's funder, the Ohio-based Wexner Foundation. A far-right extremist member of Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu's government, Ben-Gvir tweeted, he made the decision to sever ties between the police and the foundation because of the foundation's involvement and cooperation with distinctly left-wing groups like Breaking the Silence. Both the Wexner Foundation and Breaking the Silence, an advocacy group that publishes testimonies by Israeli combat soldiers about human rights abuses in the West Bank, have long been targets of the Israeli far right. The foundation rejected Ben-Gvir's allegation of ideological bias. We are not now, nor have we ever been associated with any political party or movement, Wexner said. Five police officers who were slated to attend the fellowship program at Harvard next year can no longer do so. The Wexner Foundation's money comes from American Jewish philanthropist Les Wexner, a billionaire who made his fortune off retail brands like Victoria's Secret and Bath and Body Works. The foundation has lately faced backlash over Wexner's personal and financial ties to the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, even as it continues its many activities focused on the development of Jewish leaders in a wide range of fields. More than 250 Israelis have graduated from Wexner's leadership programs. They involve a period of study at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. The list of alumni features former Israeli Defense Forces Chief of Staff Aviv Kochavi, Ami Ayalon, a former head of the Shin Bet, the security agency, and Yair Golan, a former top-ranking general and a member of Knesset, in addition to many mid-level officials in Israel's police and security establishment. Ben-Gvir is not the first person on the Israeli right to target the foundation. Some of his political allies say the fellowship's work to spread progressive ideas imported from the U.S. across Israel. Skepticism of programs serving Israelis but funded by American Jewish philanthropy manifested regularly since Netanyahu's most recent government, which includes extreme far-right partners in senior roles, took office late last year. One Netanyahu ally hoped to block a large cross-section of mainstream American donors from involvement in Israeli education. He resigned from office before he could implement the plan. Ben-Gvir's concern over the effect of American ideas on senior Israeli officers mirrors criticism that comes from the American left. The anti-Zionist group Jewish Voice for Peace has long campaigned against official trips to Israel taken by U.S. police officials, saying these exchanges bolster policing that leads to brutality towards civilians. Israeli officials and the U.S. police delegations, as well as trip organizers, deny those allegations, saying the trips consist of lectures, meetings, and tours, no physical training at all. The war of ideas about Israel gets more vicious every day. And to think, the Talmud, the greatest work of Jewish law and lore, manages to incorporate 66 long, complex tractates, that's volumes of Talmud, of intense Jewish argumentation, without ever banning the people who lose the arguments. I thought that the greatness of Judaism was its ability to integrate disparate ideas, viewpoints, even concepts, into a greater whole, all while encouraging questioning, debate, and discussion, cultivating disagreement for the higher purpose of pursuing truth and meaning. Censoring people and institutions you disagree with to the point of depriving them of experiencing new viewpoints and seeing facts for themselves, that's simply wrong and deeply un-Jewish. That's not just me, one single rabbi, saying this. It's the entirety of our incredible tradition that demonstrates the fallacy of this kind of conduct. It's destructive, narrowing, and an abuse of power. And mostly, it's the opposite of what any observant Jew should represent. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world. To welcome back our guest this morning, here's a musical introduction on the theme of her new novel.
By the waters of Babylon, we lay down and wept for thee, Zion. We remember thee, remember thee, remember thee, Zion.
We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Michelle Cameron, is the author of the new novel, Babylon, a novel of Jewish captivity. A terrific telling of the story of the destruction of the temple and the experience of the Jews in Babylonian captivity. Her earlier books include Beyond the Ghetto Gates, about Napoleon liberating the Jews of the ghettos of Europe, The Fruit of Her Hands, set in a period of medieval persecution of Jews, and In the Shadow of the Globe, a Shakespeare story. In Babylon, in all of your books, you focus on woman heroes. There's a great deal in the Tanakh and the Bible about the destruction, the first destruction, the exile. Not a lot about the women. Tell us how you kind of bring their stories out.
So there really are not a lot about the women in a lot of history. And
that's true.
And so I think what I tend to do is try to give those women voices that they wouldn't otherwise have. One of the interesting facts about The Fruit of Her Hands is that we learn a great deal about Mara of Rothenburg, but nothing ever mentions his wife, even though we know he had a wife, because in fact we do know about his children. So with my novels, being a woman myself, I suppose, I do sort of focus on the woman's side of the story and try and bring that to life.
The actual Babylonian exile takes place in stages, at least as it's delineated in the description in the Hebrew Bible. Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonians invade, they take away the powerful and the aristocrats, they take away the workers, and then they come in and smash everything else. How did you decide what to focus on in that story?
Well, I really focused on the fact that he, that last destruction, when he literally took thousands of really the more privileged Jews and pulled them out of the country. I do mention one of the earlier exiles because, of course, Daniel and his two friends are already in Babylon when the novel starts. So that, yes, I do sort of mention this slow progression. There is a passage in the novel where Seraph, who is a musician, talks about the fact that, he served in a palace that was basically bereft of music because of that earlier conquest. And then he himself is taken with the captives in that last exile.
You can't really go to Iraq to do research on Babylon. And obviously 2,600 years is a long way to go back. What did you find most surprising in the research you were doing and incorporated into the book?
Well, I talk a lot about how they made bricks. And there were basically two types of bricks. There were those that were fired in the kiln, which were more stable. And there were those that they simply put in mold and hardened in the sun. And those would start to weep when it would rain. So that was a surprising fact that I really enjoyed inserting in various places in the novel. I was very fortunate that when I started my research, the Metropolitan Museum in New York actually had an exhibit all about Babylon. And so I was able to go to that to see artifacts. There's one point where I talk about a specific dagger and how it's constructed. And I used really the description from the Met to include in the novel. So there were a lot of little things that I was able to find about life in Babylonia that I incorporated.
In writing about the Babylonians and then the Persians, you know, of course, your protagonists are Judeans in this kind of Jewish focus. You're writing about people that are quite brutal, really. Was that hard or easy to do?
You know, it's a really funny thing. It's I find myself gravitating toward novels that have this kind of brutality in them. I am very much not a brutal person.
Just wondering. I don't know. You know, could be some suppressed urges here, Michelle. Do you?
I really don't.
Tell me how you feel about that.
You know, when we teach our younger students in the writer's circle, we often tell them that, you know, anything can happen on the page as long as it stays on the page. And so I think that that is what happens with my writing. But let's face it, these were brutal times, and the attitudes of people towards life and death were different. And so in order to be authentic, I definitely had to capture that.
The novel spans a long period of time, multiple generations. Who's your favorite character?
That's a really difficult question. I think it changed as I wrote the novel. Obviously, Sarah, who is the matriarch of the family, was definitely a favorite character of mine. When she fell in love with Seraph the musician, I think I fell in love with Seraph the musician. But I also really loved Uri, who was the scribe and who was very conflicted because he married a Babylonian woman, and yet his whole existence was based on the biblical stories that he was transcribing. And then at the end of the novel, it was Hava, who is Sarah's grandmother and who finally fulfills her promise of being able to return to her farm on the outskirts of Jerusalem.
You know, it's a story that begins with destruction and slavery and then ends in redemption and return. Sounds kind of Jewish.
It does, doesn't it?
Were you influenced by, you know, thinking about more contemporary Jewish history? Is there something there kind of represented in these antiquities?
I believe that, you know, as American Jews, we all struggle with the whole issue of assimilation versus maintaining religious tradition. And so that was definitely part of it. Sarah's children all chose different paths in Babylon. And one of her daughters completely assimilated to the point where she is literally lining up the gods of Babylon and worshiping them. And so I think that definitely filtered through. the struggle that we ourselves have. Where do we draw our own personal line?
The book Babylon is, I mean, it's huge, and not unbelievably long, I don't know, some 400 pages, but it's so rich. I mean, how long did this take you to write?
Well, I actually wrote this book immediately as I was trying to find an agent, and then she was trying to find a publisher for The Fruit of Her Hand. So the first draft of this book is more than a decade old. As I grew as a writer, I would come back and revisit it a number of times. So it's hard to sort of quantify how long it took me to write this novel, but it was a long time, and it was a long time before it was accepted by my publisher, by which
it's funny. Writing is only part of the issue. You teach writers and help writers. What's the hardest part?
Of stepping back and making sure that it's their creativity coming to the fore, especially with my adult students. I can so often sort of see where they should take it, but you can't just say, do this.
Write this now.
Exactly. So a lot of it has to do with, it's not my book, it's their book. My job is to help them see that, to see where they can go next. And one of the wonderful things about that is often they see a much better path than I would have. In terms of teaching the younger students, the kids, it's also a matter of let them create, give them some ideas and get out of the way. Because again, they produce things that are just so unbelievable. Especially the younger kids' creativity is just off the chart. So it's really a lot of fun.
I want to thank Michelle Cameron for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Her novel is called Babylon, a novel of Jewish captivity. It's a great read. You'll learn a lot, and I think you'll thoroughly enjoy the book as well. Where can people go to find out more about you, Michelle, and to find out more about Babylon?
My website itself is michelle-cameron.com. And certainly Babylon itself is available on all the major booksellers. It's, you can walk into your local bookseller. I really love to support
independent bookshops. Absolutely.
Exactly. Yep. And so if someone walks in and says, can you order this book? It's very easy them to do so.
Michelle, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. This was delightful.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week when our guest will be Rabbi Amiel Hirsch of Stephen Wise Free Synagogue in New York, organizer of the recent Recharging Reform Judaism Conference. And please join us at Congregation Beit Simcha this Saturday night for Slichot and every Friday night for services in Oneg Shabbat. 6:30 p.m. for Shabbat services, Saturday morning 2, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, live in person and available on our Facebook page. And especially join us for High Holy Day services at Beit Simcha, 12111 North Lachoya Road. Come for Rosh Hashanah. It begins Friday night, September 15th, Saturday, September 16th, Yom Kippur, Sunday night, September 24th, and Monday day, September 25th. All led by me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and our Beit Simcha musicians. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, to sign up. To play us out, here's cantor Yaakov Lemmer and the Jerusalem Cantors Choir in the great Dohain Synagogue in Budapest. I've sung there. Singing Zochreinu L'chaim, remember us for life, for the coming High Holy Days. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week, we pray profoundly, of peace.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.